This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
We have an idea that we'd like to talk to you about.
It's going to be online any second. This is going to be news.
Who should we send it to first?
Just a couple of people. The question is, who are they going to send it to?
The site got 2,200 hits within 2 hours.
1,000. 22,000.
They don't want you. They want your idea.
We don't know what it can be. We don't know what it will be. We know that it is cool.
Let's sue him in federal court.
If you guys were the inventors of Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Popcorn Culture. I'm Lee Chwee Lin, and with me today is Sharmila Ganesan. And sitting in for Arvind Yuvaraj, who is, I like to think, you know, watching the sunset somewhere, is Hezrul Ashraf, calling in from home.
Hi, everyone.
So today we have the first of, I guess, a pair of double-built shows in some ways, because tomorrow we are going to be reviewing a documentary that premiered on Netflix called The Social Dilemma, which looks really, in many ways, at the issues surrounding social networks. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to be throwing back to The Social Network, which is 10 years old. And it is, of course, the award-winning David Fincher directed, Aaron Sorkin written film.
Yeah, and I think it's a neat sort of fit that happened without us quite realizing it, because we were talking about doing The Social Dilemma as a review. And then one of us brought up that, oh, do you know it's been 10 years since The Social Network came out? And it just felt like such a natural pairing. And now having watched both of them together, I feel like they're so, so relevant as a double bill today.
Yeah, so for me, I think what really stood out, the first thing that came to my mind, Sharmila, when you brought up how similar they are, really is Tristan Harris from The Social Dilemma, who said that, you know, it's astounding how 50 white men can decide the fate of 2 billion people in a room, right, in Silicon Valley. And looking back at The Social Network, that really is what it was. You know, a few college guys in a very prestigious university who had the privilege of doing some very disturbing things, right? Because the way that Facebook was started was that they stole the photos of these girls and post it up on the internet for everyone to rate.
Well, I think there are a few different ways of looking at this, and perhaps we're being overly colored by a review that we haven't done yet, actually, because one way to look at it is through that larger lens. I mean, we've all now been using Facebook for, you know, more than a decade.
More than, at least 15 years for me.
Correct. Yeah. So one way to look at it is as an origin story of Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg and all the rest of it. But the other side of it, and I think that it's the one that Aaron Sorkin has gone on record as saying he's more interested in this, is the human part of it. Because it does tell the story of the formation and the beginning of Facebook. But the structure of The Social Network is really quite ingenious, because the way it's framed is, you know, it's part of 2 separate deposition rooms. And Mark Zuckerberg, years or, you know, 3 to 4 years after the whole college heyday moments, is being sued by 2 separate people, one of whom is his former best friend. And I think it's that very human drama that warms up what is otherwise a very cold, calculating film.
And I'm glad that you mentioned Sorkin, because the other half of that equation is, of course, David Fincher, who directed Social Network. And I think, you know, most people will know Fincher other than the occasional foray into drama like Benjamin Button. You know, they'll know him for his thrillers. And then something like The Social Network came along, and he brings that sort of thriller finesse to the film, because, I mean, boardroom discussions on finance and shares are not the most exciting, but he manages to find the drama in it with that. And we've seen him do this with his thrillers, the intercutting of the past and the present, the contrasting of personalities that are wildly different, who want different things. I suppose the dark side of what it means to be human as well. And yeah, so nobody would have, on paper, thought this would have made a great film. And yet, even 10 years later, it's such an exciting watch.
Yeah, and I think the pacing of the movie for me sort of pointed to I thought I was going to get bored. I was only 16 when I watched that movie, but somehow the there was the momentum, you know, the back and forth of the deposition, but also the social quirks that I, as like a 16-year-old, could relate to, you know, of guys being sort of bro-y and the environment of, I guess, the excitement of spreading of rumors or, you know, spreading around, and the kind of social environment that they were in.
So, guys, we should talk about the central guy, because I think that this movie, yes, Aaron Sorkin's script and his classic, you know, wall-to-wall dialogue approach is one thing. David Fincher's visual and, I guess, directorial finesse is quite another. And at the very center of it is this performance from Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg. And it is kind of a miraculous thing because he is so unlikable, you know.
And yet more likable than the actual Mark Zuckerberg.
Isn't that strange?
It is so, now watching it now, because I didn't think this 10 years ago, but now having seen Zuckerberg do the Senate hearings and all of the interviews, it's so, that's why I feel that as a sort of a piece that stands up, it really does, because Jesse Eisenberg is a better Mark Zuckerberg than the real Zuckerberg.
But that's the thing. I felt a bit distanced, so not in the sense that, you know, he didn't perform well, but the character itself, I felt I felt like really just peering into this someone who I think was, you know, socially awkward, a bit, maybe a bit disturbed or somewhat lonely, but was at the same time was in this power, this position of privilege, right, to be able to spend the time to do this on the side and deal with the depositions, and yet at the end of it just you know, win it and you know, make this great brand that is Facebook today.
Well, so the thing about Jesse Eisenberg's performance as Mark Zuckerberg, for me anyway, is that that unlikableness, that sort of singularity, I think that he manages to play the hurt underneath that quite well. Mm-hmm. And what I enjoy about it is also that we have seen this done time and time again, where somebody that has all these character traits, who is arrogant, who is awkward, who ultimately ends up successful, who pushes away our romantic relationships as well as close friendships, and these people are valorized, you know. We've seen other movies, especially when they're male characters, where they're regarded as, yeah, exactly, this is how geniuses should behave. This is normal. And in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, so I'm not comparing him to the real life. We should say we're talking about 2010 social networks Mark Zuckerberg. This version of him, I think, is played in a way that is simultaneously, you know, there is that cold remove. There is also the pushing of, yes, he is a genius, and the acknowledgement that he's really not a good friend. And it the minor hurts and slights and passive-aggressive digs, the way they come out in those small moments, I think says so much.
There's this great scene in the film, and I don't want to give it away, but you know, it's just such a great scene. Rashida Jones, who is his lawyer, there's this great scene where she tells him, after I think he kind of tries to ask her out very clumsily, and she says, "You're not really," and I'm paraphrasing, "a jerk, but you just try so hard to seem like one." So, and I think that really encapsulates so much of how his character is in the film. And also, I think watching it now, I realize they were also very, very young. They were incredibly young.
It's trippy in the first place. I mean, this has nothing to do with the film. It's trippy to watch all these actors be so young.
Yes, yes. Armie Hammer.
I know.
I'm like, oh my God, the Winklevosses.
The Winklevi.
The Winklevi. I can never say their name. But in so many ways, I think realizing... The film was criticized for actually humanizing Mark Zuckerberg even back then too much, and sort of absolving him of some of the responsibility for a lot of this. But I think in a way, you kind of need that in a film. No, you can't you can't have someone that you can't empathize with. You don't like him, but you get him by the end of the film.
But that, I think that's the genius of the movie, right? Like when you consider that a teenager was responsible for all this, you sort of, I couldn't help but to feel, I guess, some sort of sympathy, or whether it's pity, you know, and that someone, you know, he didn't have like a proper adult guide to really look up to, right? And it seems like it was, you know, it was all sort of inevitable that he in a way did the things he did, because I mean, he was very young and he was under a lot of pressure, and the kind of environment he was in to succeed and to, I guess, to prove his worth. I really can't blame him, like just from that movie.
So while we're talking about adult guidance, after this, we're going to be talking about Sean Parker. Because we have to talk about Justin Timberlake in this movie, guys. We've avoided it for 10 minutes. It's coming. We're talking today about 2010's The Social Network, because tomorrow we're reviewing The Social Dilemma, which came out this year, very recently, actually. If you'd like to weigh in on The Social Network, do you remember it fondly? Did you enjoy it? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You know, I've already apologized in the Crimson to the ABHW, to Fuerza Latina, and to any women at Harvard who may have been insulted, as I take it that they were. As for any charges stemming from the breach of security, I believe I deserve some recognition from this board.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
I don't understand.
Which part?
You deserve recognition.
I believe I pointed out some pretty gaping holes in your system.
Hello, you are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila and Hezril. Together, we are throwing it back today, 10 years, to The Social Network. We've spoken about how much we enjoy David Fincher's work on this. Aaron Sorkin's script is superb. Jesse Eisenberg, fantastic. I'm just going to say Andrew Garfield was also extremely good.
Oh, Andrew Garfield's the beating heart of this film.
And we can get to that, but first some negatives. One negative, one giant negative. So I did not like this performance when I watched it the first two times, let's say, you know, way back when. And rewatching it this time, I found Justin Timberlake unbearable. So he plays Sean Parker and I can't.
Oh, so interesting. When you said negative, I thought you just meant that Sean Parker himself was odious.
So there's a part of me now, you know, this is maybe my third or fourth time watching this film in its entirety. And I wonder whether they cast somebody who was not going to be the best actor to show that distance and that difference from, you know, the original pairing of Severin and Zuckerberg. Because honestly, Jesse Eisenberg and Andrew Garfield are extremely good and Justin Timberlake just isn't at that level.
So I think I'm on that camp of, I think it was a casting move that worked, because Justin Timberlake was also at that point in his career where he's kind of like that too big for his boots pop star. And then he played this character, Sean Parker, you know, he of Napster. And it all worked for me really well. Worked enough for me to really dislike him in the film. You know, if you have the hero or the heart that's Andrew Garfield playing Eduardo Saverin, and then you have the misunderstood, tortured Mark Zuckerberg.
Sado.
The enabler and the real quote-unquote bad guy has to be someone else. And that was Sean Parker played by Justin Timberlake, and I actually really enjoyed him.
And I wonder actually if the whole boy band background of Justin Timberlake really allowed his characteristics and traits to come through, right? And I think Sharma was speaking to that uncertainty, perhaps the transition that Justin was in. You know, I'm not sure if it really worked to his advantage, because his character in the movie is really this, you know, overconfident guy who isn't really exactly in the driver's seat when it comes to the business side of things, right? So there's sort of an air of like, he sort of compensates this through the confidence and his swagger that might not necessarily translate to his business his business abilities.
Yeah, I get it. I understand the argument. I just found those scenes still annoying, you know, so like cringy, not a little bit of cringe, but mostly I just thought, oh, I wish they'd gone with someone
like,
else.
Like, what are you doing in this movie?
Exactly. Yeah. Which was the reaction that happened at the time as well. I'm not saying anything new here. This is something that people have been saying for a little while, because this is a prestige project and it's not necessarily something. And Justin Timberlake hasn't done prestige projects since. So I don't necessarily think this is a great showcase of talent. But I understand the argument, and you know that whole idea of intense irritation does permeate every scene he's in, for me at least.
Maybe I'm a huge Fincher fan, so I like to think that was intentional. Maybe.
Apologist.
But and the thing is, as a counterpoint though, I'd like to offer up the amazingness that is Andrew Garfield. I can't remember now whether that's really the first film I saw him take on like a proper dramatic big role. But I remember going in not really knowing much about him and being all like, "Ooh, Jesse Eisenberg," and coming out just thinking how amazing Andrew Garfield was in that role, because to play that friend. And I don't know what Eduardo Saverin is like in real life. He's retired, I think, in Singapore with lots of money, so whatever. But the hurt and the sort of the realness of being a friend who's lost a friend.
And the betrayal.
Yeah. I think he nails it so well. And I think you needed that in a story like this. Otherwise, as you said, it would have been very cold.
There is a scene with a chicken.
Yes.
There is a scene that involves a chicken and the deposition room and allegations of torture. Mm-hmm. And the way that those two guys just play out that moment of their friendship fracturing was so beautiful and so heartfelt. And I think the fact that the rest of the movie is somewhat cold and smooth makes those moments of heartbreak all the more affecting, I
yeah,
feel.
No, yeah. I completely agree.
Yeah, so actually, so Andrew Garfield's character is my favorite because I think his warmth really comes through. He navigates between being a business partner and a friend, and overall, I think I out of all the characters, I think he was the most relatable to me. You know, as a 16-year-old who's sort of like finding his place and going through the teenage phase. So hands down, my favorite character.
I think he's really, in many ways, the only likable character. I will say that I just want to shout out the Winklevi situation, mm-hmm. because I forgot how funny they were.
Yeah.
So every scene that they were in, I literally said out loud to myself, "These clowns," you know, because they were so funny. And there's a lot of and I think it speaks to the power of the writing, because it's not physical comedy that's happening. A lot of it is happening in the mannerisms, mm-hmm. What's yeah. being said. More importantly, what people are willing and not willing to do. So I enjoyed those scenes
also
a lot.
Also, don't forget that those were two totally different actors, and then they just superimposed Army's face onto the other guy. Back then, that was super revolutionary.
Yeah, I definitely think they were the most animated character in terms of, like Ling mentioned, clown. I thought they were sort of cartoonish, yet they were so in place, and they just set the tone perfectly for their characters.
So, in closing, this is supposed to be a biopic. It's based on, we haven't mentioned this, but it was actually based on a book, the facts of which have been contested. And Eduardo Saverin served as a consultant on the book. So it is somewhat, you know, a one-sided story. How do we feel about that? You know, tomorrow we're going to be talking about a documentary. This does not purport to be that. It is a work of fiction. The main players have contested a lot of what happened. Does that affect your viewing of the film?
So Fincher himself, I think both Sorkin and Fincher have also come out to say this isn't really a story of the Zuckerberg. It's a version of the truth or whatever. It's an easy way to get out of a biopic.
It's a Zuckerberg.
Yeah. It doesn't bother me, to be honest, because I think if there's such a thing as the feel of a situation versus the truth of a situation, I feel like this movie captured that really well. And for me, that's, I can't actually think of a biopic that's ever been 100% true to life anyway.
It's well put. And I think that you know, I wonder if this is also like the most relatable version, right? There's always going to be many versions of a story. But I think when it comes to putting that on screen, perhaps this was the best one and the only one that perhaps a lot of people could relate to.
I think it's a good film. It's a good film. It's a great film even that managed to mine drama out of something that is fundamentally very, very dry. And I accept the machinations, I suppose, of the plot, mostly because I'm not Mark Zuckerberg, who had said, I think, I just wish that people would wait, you know, till I died to make a film about me, or, you know, not make it while I was alive.
I don't think he'd like that film either, given the way things are going.
So... be that as it may, we've been talking today about a version of Mark Zuckerberg and a version of the Facebook story in our throwback to The Social Network, which was directed by David Fincher, written by Aaron Sorkin in 2010. Let us know what you think. You can, of course, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, write to us at movies@bfm.my, and find us on Twitter and Instagram at BFM Popcorn. This is Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.